So we talked about, just for this tape here, we talked about bodhisattvas, we talked about bodhicitta, we talked about what we're going to be studying is basic sitting meditation, which in some ways is the preliminary. The very preliminary is trying to get you to sit, which is what I'm going to be talking about. If you, I haven't even talked about that yet. And then there's the sitting practice, and then there's the practice of Tonglin, which is a type of meditation that we're going to be studying. And then there's the practice of working with slogans, and hopefully we'll get to a couple of the slogans tonight within the realm of what we call absolute bodhicitta. And if you remember last week, just important to kind of review, bodhicitta has three qualities. It has a quality of being soft and feminine and compassionate and a lot of empathy. It has the masculine, more masculine quality of sharp, precise, cut through with wisdom, and being concentrated. And then it has the quality of what we call shunyata, or of openness and spaciousness, of which, of course, compassion can come out of, and also directness can come out of it too, because wisdom directs us in that way. So we actually started a step ahead. Let's go back a step. Let's go back to what the preliminaries are. So the preliminaries, the first preliminary is to reflect on how precious life is. So if I was to try to encourage you to sit meditation, I would try to say, okay, maybe this is the only opportunity you're ever going to have to meditate this last 10 minutes. Let's get the most out of it. You know, it's do or die or something like that, you know. And so you really bring your concentration to it. So the idea is that you've been given this precious life. Don't waste it. Don't waste it. So, you know, like in Zen monasteries, there's a little han where you call people to meditation. There's usually a little thing there that says, you know, practice life and death is imminent. Practice. Don't take it for granted. Or there's even a quote sometimes that says, practice as if your hair's on fire. You know, that kind of energy. You know, not like too laid back, but with some sense of, no, I really want to pay attention. I really want to be with it. I really want to be present. It's really important to do that. As I was reflecting on that, when I thought in our tradition, there's a section in here. Remember in the Fukan Zazengi, in the back, where Dogen is giving instructions on meditation, why you would want to meditate. And let's see if I can define it. Here it is. Next to the last paragraph. This is what he's saying. He's trying to really encourage you and raise your interest, you know, raise your enthusiasm for this practice. He says, you have been given the pivotal opportunity of human form. Do not pass your days and nights in vain. You are taking care of the essential activity of the Buddha way. Who would take wasteful delight in the spark of a flintstone? In other words, this flintstone, this spark of truth. Besides, form and substance are like the dew on a grass, the fortunes of life like a dart of lightning, emptied in an instant, vanished in a flash. So this is a beautiful way in our own tradition, the Zen tradition, of saying exactly what Atisha says in one of the preliminaries. This life is really precious. And don't waste it. You know, practice. Really practice hard. Awaken. Please awake. There was another, when I was preparing a lecture last week, I ran across, this was on why would you study the precepts? So this is what Dato Lurie says about the precepts. It makes me wonder how often any of us appreciates how profound this practice is. Do we really hear it? Do we sense it? Do we feel it in our bones, right down to the marrow and every cell in our body? Or is it just another fling, a dharma fling? It is vitally important to appreciate this life. In one sense, that is what taking refuge in the three treasures is about. Really is about appreciating our life. appreciating this life that you have, to practice appreciating all life, waking up again and again to that feeling. So he's saying it again. This is in the century, saying exactly the same thing that Atisha is saying. And then, of course, in the Tibetan tradition, I'm going to talk a little bit today about a continuity of consciousness. And I don't know whether to talk about it. I guess I'll talk about it now because it comes under several of the preliminary practices. With the Tibetans hold a little bit different point of view on death than, say, Zen does. Zen is more, and I've said this before on Sunday, Zen is a little more agnostic. In other words, we don't really know, we don't really talk about it so much. What's really important is just to practice here and now. Because if you practice here and now, your karma is going to change your karma, and it'll affect how you are and everybody around you. And so why even, you don't even have to worry about it so much. And Buddha even, they have quoted statements by Buddha where people said, is there life after death? And Buddha said, you know, I'm not going to answer that question. It's just speculative. It's not important. What's important is to just, he says, if you come with an arrow in you, do you ask all kinds of questions about, you know, what kind of arrow is it? What kind of point is it? You know, no, you extract the arrow. In other words, right here, right now, what's causing the pain? How do we extract the arrow? That's what Buddha's teaching was. Now, there is only one koan out of 1,500 koans. I haven't read all of them by any means. But there's one koan where they did ask, you know, they said, well, you know, what are you going to do after death? And the teacher said, well, you know, you'll see a cow out in the field and it'll have my initial on it. And will it be me? Yes and no. And I like that because it means when you die, really, you know, could you point to a tree out there and say, is that tree your mother? Well, you couldn't say it is your mother when his mother died. Last year was there. You couldn't say it is, but you couldn't say it isn't completely, right? You know, you couldn't really say because, you know, just on the level of physics, what goes, nothing completely vanishes. So you can reflect on it at that level, and that's kind of the level at which I usually approach it. But the Tibetans have a little different feeling, and I think you know that, and I want to explain it to you because it could be confusing for you, because they talk a lot about reincarnation. And a lot of their incentive for practice is based on reincarnation. In other words, they feel that the reason why you want to lead a good life and the reason why you want to practice meditation and wake up is because not only is it going to be better in this life, which as Zen people think is that's just enough motivation, they think it's going to affect where you're going to go after. So what is it that's out there that's reincarnating? And the way the Tibetans explain this, it's like what they call continuity of consciousness. So in other words, you are, and I've explained this before, you're different now than you were when you came in, right? Your cells are different. How you think about things is different because you've had more information, right? You're a different person. And what Buddha says, if you really paid attention to that, you see you're changing all the time, so there's nothing you can really lock down behind as a constant, solid Kate or Bruce. That's the essence of Buddha's teaching, what I just gave you right there. The more we deepen our insight into that, into our vipassana into that, the more we don't solidify behind some identity. And that has tremendous implications in terms of how we're much more flexible and open, and we don't have something we have to defend and hang on to, you know, the deeper we practice. The Tibetans believe, so both Zen and Tibetans believe that. Change, 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 change. Death. Okay. Zen would be more like, well, we're not really sure. Something goes over. We know something goes over. We don't know what exactly goes over. And you'll find some Zen people talk about reincarnation, and Buddha certainly talked about past lives, what he was in many lives in the past. Of course, he was from the Indian tradition, which reincarnation was stronger. The Tibetans believe that a continuity of consciousness carries over. And this continuity of consciousness doesn't have the same memories and mental formations that it had before. But there is a consciousness, not a personal identity, but a consciousness that gets carried over. And this consciousness goes into this bardo state. And this bardo state looks down, and because of its karma, its momentum of how it's led its life, picks a rebirth and then goes down and rebirths into that. And depending on your karmic inclination, if you had a lot of avarice or greed, the law of karma is that you will be projected into that new rebirth. So if you had a lot of delusion, you'd probably maybe be, you know, good chance you'd be incarnated into an animal. You know, that continuity of consciousness would find a host and would go into it, right? So that's what the Tibetans believe. Some of us Zen people are a little suspicious of that, because the reason why is because Buddha said there's no self. There's no, and it's beginning to feel that continuity of consciousness, beginning to feel a little bit like what Buddha said isn't a self. It's clear that there's something that continues. It continues in your children. It continues in all the people that you've educated and you've influenced in your life. It's included in anything you've put out. You know, so that, in a sense, your continuity of consciousness. But does it actually incarnate into another, like the Dalai Lama or a Tukul? You know, there's a big debate in the Buddhist community. And even people that firmly believe in it say you don't have to believe in incarnation to be a Buddhist. And there's a very good book, if you'd like to read more deeply about this. Stephen Batchelor and Robert Thurman have a book, Buddhism Without Beliefs, where Stephen Batchelor, who was a Tibetan practitioner for a while and a wonderful, brilliant teacher, he takes the position of being an agnostic. He just doesn't know. And Thurman takes the position, absolutely, no question about it, and it's really important. I would not practice as hard as I did if I didn't think that this continuity of consciousness was going to be out there. So this precious human life has a little different significance to Tibetans, because they, you know, you could get incarnated as an animal. And once you get incarnated as an animal, you have less capacity to develop compassion. Animals have less capacity to develop compassion. Hungry ghosts had even more, less of a compassion. And the hell realms, which is the third realm, they have even less of a compassion. So once you get in these lower realms, it's very hard to extricate yourself. So you had better use this human birth. So can you see why the Tibetans really emphasize this thing about continuity? They really amp it up. I think it's quite sufficient to know, you know, that you're hurting yourself and you're hurting other people in this immediate life. And I think that's more consistent with Buddhist teaching. But, hey, you know, the Dalai Lama believes this, and who am I to refute that? And you're welcome to explore this belief on your own and come to your own decision about that. Something continues, you know, I know that. So is that kind of, I thought it would be important, and it's also, yeah, it's important how they look at karma. It's important how they look at the preciousness of human life. It's important how they think of impermanence, reflecting on impermanence, which is the next preliminary that they reflect on. Yes, Dennis?
Just a quick question.
Yeah.
Technically, can karma affect your current life, or is karma, strictly speaking, only something that has an impact on something after this life?
Yes, both. Karma, well, according to the Tibetans, all schools of Buddhism would say it affects your current life. You know, if you go and close your eyes and walk across Palm Drive Avenue or Main Street enough times, you'll get hit by a car. That's your karma for not being awake, right? You don't pay attention, you're using a hammer, you're going to hit your... So you get immediate... We're always getting immediate feedback about our karma, you know. I ate a very large chocolate chip cookie at 10 o'clock the other night, and I was awake from 2 o'clock till 3:30. That was my karma, You know, that was pretty immediate karma, right? And we all experience that kind of immediate karma. And we purify and we pay attention, we're mindful of it, so we don't create this. The Tibetans say that this continuity of consciousness really ups the ante, because you usually don't get enlightened in one lifetime. It takes many lifetimes, they believe, and therefore you're working for the next lifetime. You know, which is very, you know, helpful if you're in a situation where you don't have a lot of control over your environment. You can kind of say, well, you know, if I work really hard, the next life I'll have a better incarnation. It really is an incentive. If you could really prove it, it could be a tremendous incentive. Right? Wouldn't it be? I mean, it would be if you really knew absolutely that there was reincarnation. So, but you do know that every thought you have is reincarnated. Every thought you have, every angry thought you have, or kind or compassionate thought affects the whole world, actually. So that's pretty serious karma right there that we should take responsibility for right here. So how precious life is. Let's see, what else did I have about that? What are the points? A couple of the points in karma. Let's see if I can remember what about karma. So one thing about the hell realm, which is interesting, the teaching, I love this. If you're in a hell realm, it's hard to cultivate compassion. But if you do, if you are able somehow when you're in a hell realm, to either in a future life, if you want to believe that, or right now when you're in a hell realm, you will be liberated immediately. You get a free pass. What is it in Monopoly? Free get out of jail card, right? You get a free get out of jail card if you create compassion. And isn't that true? Isn't that really true when you're in a hell realm? When you're really angry and pissed off or whatever, and you really can raise the thought of legitimate compassion for yourself or others, it's a get out of jail card. It really does. It's true. So you can believe that in this life, or you can believe if you're going to get reincarnated in the next life. Let's see what else I had down here. One thing is kind of interesting. It's true, if you're in a lower realm, you know, there are people that live in kind of an animal realm, right? Just driven by their desires, or very deluded people. It's hard for them to extricate themselves, you know. If you're in the God realms, and this is a metaphor, if you're in a God realm, God realms are not good to be reincarnated into. I'm just talking about the Tibetan. Because in the God realm, there's not enough suffering to liberate you. And maybe that's true. When you think of people that are in the God realms, you know, they're really good looking, or life is really easy for them. You know, maybe they were born on a beach in Hawaii or something. I don't know. You know, are there really realms like that? I don't know. But I think some people have it a lot easier. But the human realm is the ideal realm. Because the human realm has a balance of pain and joy. It's a balance of the animal realm and the God realm. And it gives you enough pain to wake up, but not so much pain, usually, although for some people that's not true, so much pain that you are buried by it. Kind of interesting theory, don't you think? I mean, it kind of makes sense to me. And you can apply that just in as a metaphor that there are some people in God realms that they just don't have a clue about spiritual practice because they don't have enough suffering in their lives, you know? And there's other people that have so much suffering that they just can't, they don't have any ability to practice. In fact, that's a very important point for the preciousness of human life. The other part of it is time. We should be so grateful that we have time to listen to the Dharma and to sit meditation. Maybe most people on the earth do not have that ability and opportunity. Isn't that right? I mean, they have to really really struggle for food and safety and shelter and survival. So we should be extraordinarily grateful that we have the opportunity to cultivate this. So the more we can cultivate this state of mind, the more we will want to practice. We won't take our meditation practice for granted. So this is why it's called the preliminaries to do this.
Can you repeat that last sentence? I didn't hear your words. So this is why...
Why we should practice very hard, because, you know, we have this opportunity that's been given to us, you know. Don't take it for granted. Somehow we're very fortunate. We're extremely fortunate. So the next one is impermanence. You meditate on impermanence. I remember Suzuki Roshi said, somebody asked him, could you just sum up Buddhism in one sentence? And he said, everything's impermanent. So again, the sense that things are impermanent, don't take it for granted. You're not going to have forever. We keep thinking we're going to have forever, but we're not. It's moving along pretty quickly. Mm-hmm. Let's try to wake up and, you know, hold that in your consciousness. And primarily is set your priorities. What are your priorities in life? And impermanence would move you, what all this is trying to do is it's trying to move you into the priority of spiritual practice as a way from just fame and glory and making lots of money. And that's another reflection. In the preliminaries, the reflection is, what do you really want in life? What's really important in life? And so that there's a phrase called the mundane treasures. Do you know what the mundane treasures are? Sure you do. Yes.
Money. House.
Money, good looks, good personality, lots of fame, all the things that we think are the major treasures, right? These are the mundane treasures, right? And then there's eight, what they call, so in other words, you're thinking, what do you really want to orient on in life? You know, do you want to orient on becoming wealthy? And then the opposite of becoming wealthy is afraid of not being wealthy, or a lot of fear around wealth. So that's one continuum. The other one is wanting lots of praise, really needing a lot of praise. And the other side of that is really reacting when you don't get praise or people denigrate you in any way, right? So these things are all, they're not bad to seek after fame or profit or success or wealth. It's not that they're bad in and of themselves. That's really clear. It's not like if you do this, it's bad. It just means if that's your main orientation, you're not going to be spending enough time on your spiritual practice, because this isn't what's going to really make you happy. It's called the counterfeit dharma. Because it's counterfeit. People think it's the real thing. And it's true, isn't it? I mean, the exercise I had for you tonight was, which one of these does it really grab you? Are you more hooked into? Do you really think that's what's going to make you happy? Is it going to be fame? Is it going to be praise? Is it going to be wealth? You know, is it going to be success? You know, what is it? And it's not that you shouldn't move towards that, but how much of it is it out of balance? And so that's what it's asking you to look at. The next one is that you should look at the problem of samsaric existence, which means that you should really investigate cause and effect. What Dennis was saying about karma, cause and effect. And that if you really study the Dharma and you study people that have practiced the Dharma, that the conclusion, and if you do it yourself, and again, the teachers all say, you should go into it with some skepticism, some hesitancy, and until you prove it. Try to prove it yourself. If you don't prove it, then you should move on to something else. It isn't the path for you, you know. But if you can prove it, and many, many hundreds of thousands of people have proved it, See if it doesn't make you happier by studying the 16 bodhisattva precepts and studying these slogans. See if they don't really make you happier. Right? Somebody asked the Dalai Lama, do you think we're really getting happier as a race? It just seems like there's, you know, a lot of war and pestilence and starvation, and we're not seem to be able to free ourselves of conflict. And so when I ask you that question, what do you think? Do you think the world is getting happier? Or are we becoming, is our consciousness evolving, do you think?
I think so. You
could guess. What would be your proof of that?
Just comparing my upbringing to now, I think that there is more outrage and upset about injustice and about lump injustice in the whole than there was previously. Maybe it's more my awareness or more the crowd I hang with.
Yeah.
But I think just in the world that there's more, just that's not acceptable.
Yeah.
Whereas before that was sort of like, well, that's life.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, that's the Dalai Lama's position. And I agree with him. I think it's true. I mean, look at in terms of just, I mean, in this country, the relationship with race and women's rights, not that we don't have a huge way to go, but there's been, and that countries are making an effort to try to help each other. That didn't happen, 100 years ago. Now, I know a lot of people would argue against this, but I am with the Dalai Lama. I'm more optimistic. I think there is a raising in consciousness. I believe that.
Well, I think that that's a lot of it.
And how much of that is because people practice the Buddha Dharma, I don't know, but they seem to be more connected. The world feels more connected. We're more concerned. We're what's happening here and what's happening there, and I think that's making some difference.
So I'm thinking of in terms of the level of consciousness that my parents had, when they were raising me, and the level of consciousness that my daughter has, who's raising a child now.
Yeah.
It's just an amazing difference.
Yes.
So I would say yes.
I think of how my parents raised me as best they could, and how I've tried to raise my children. And you raised, haven't we all done a better job? I mean, really, than our parents did.
We're hoping.
I'm
over here.
Come on,
Jay.
Could we do better? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Well, I'm thinking of things like my mom is the same age, and she's grew up in the Deep South, just very conservative. Church-going person,
yeah.
But I know people at her same age who were groundbreaking people in the '60s. So far, and it's odd.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, let's see here. We need to move. We need to get to one of the slogans here. Okay. So the first slogan is an important slogan. So this first slogan comes under absolute bodhicitta. Absolute bodhicitta is just that open, expansive, all-inclusive awareness. Relative bodhicitta is when we start to narrow it down to specific, like, oh, let's help that person. Let's take that homeless cat home. Let's go feed, let's visit that person in the hospital. So Tong Lin is working on relative bodhicitta, but you need to cultivate a sense of absolute bodhicitta. The better you cultivate a sense of absolute bodhicitta, the more you want to move out with a sense of compassion. So that's why they're focusing the first slogans on absolute bodhicitta. So the first slogan is, regard all dharmas as dreams. Regard all dharmas as dreams. What does that mean? So let me ask you, where in your life have you felt things are kind of dreamlike? Just aren't. What this is trying to do is to move you from a place of where things are solid and immovable and contracted and dense, which is usually a definition of pain, right? To a sense of openness and fluidity, and the thing that we're, you know, it isn't like me and you. It's kind of like where I am you, and you are me, and I need to take care of, you know, it's moving us in that direction. That's what the slogan is trying to do. Where in your life have you felt that your sense of, it may be a little uncomfortable sometimes, where have you felt that where it's been a little on the edge? And maybe in a good way too, like a kind of dreamy, like, because what Pima says about this is true, it's about getting you to lighten up. It's all about getting you to lighten up. Like, don't hold it so subtle, you know, like if you're, I've got to protect this cup at all costs, you know, that's what you don't want. But if you just see, well, it's your cup, here, want it? You know, I can just give it up. It's about lightening up. Where have you experienced this in your life?
Well, I got robbed at knife point a couple of years ago.
Wow.
And it was a very strange experience because I knew I wasn't afraid. I know, it sounds really strange. This young man came up, and anyway, it's not specific. I don't want to go on about the specifics, but something in me, and you know, maybe it was my practice or whatever, I knew exactly what to do in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And I avoided getting hurt.
Mm-hmm.
It felt like I was in a dream state because I felt like there was something that in me, bigger than my own day-to-day suffering self, is that communicated with this person and I don't know how to explain it. I mean, I looked this person straight in the eye. And...
Mm-hmm. Well, something gave you a sense of confidence.
Oh, yeah.
That was unusual.
Yeah.
Anybody else have a sense of that? Have you ever had an experience where... Let's make something not dramatic at all. Have you ever had this experience like you go through Christmas or Thanksgiving and it's so intense... You know, people coming, you got to get everything together, and this is going to happen, and people come, and you, all these guests and everything, and then a week later, it's like, did that really happen?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Mm-hmm. Have you ever had that experience? Like, where did all that go? Or you go on a vacation, and it's just this incredible vacation, you're up in the mountains and all this, and then a week later, you go, did I really do that? I mean, there's some memory, but have you ever had those experiences?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So... This is beginning to approach it. This is beginning to approach a little bit what we mean by take all, you know, all dharmas. Regard all dharmas as dreams. The classic examples that people give in Buddhism are a mirage. Like a mirage seems like it's real, right? You've all seen mirages, right? You've seen a mirage. And then suddenly you get close and it vanishes. Or a rainbow would be an example. Where the closer you get to a rainbow, it kind of dissipates and disappears. You don't see the rainbow. So it's beginning to get you to try to see things in a different way. It's beginning to get you to see things the way you normally see them isn't really the way it is. That's what this slogan is trying to do. This is probably the most important slogan. That's why I'm actually spending a fair amount of time on this. Yes, Dennis?
I would say it goes beyond, you know, Thanksgiving and Christmas. And it's really like every thought, you know, and every interaction. Did I just say those words? Did I just help Eileen up the driveway? You know, it's like, in a sense, the extension of that is every thought and experience you have is in some way a dream.
Yeah, that's what that's actually what they're trying to get you to move into a little bit. Let's take it a little bit further. One of the ways that one of the main ways that Tibetans use this is in the dream state. When you're in a dream state, and you're in a dream, and you touch somebody, you actually feel like you're touching them. If you're angry in a dream state, you actually experience anger. The anger that you experience in a dream state is the same anger that you experience outside the dream state, right? Why is the dream state any less real than the state we're in now? It's starting to get you, trying to get you to start to question that a little bit. How many people here do lucid dreaming? Have ever done lucid dreaming?
What do you specifically?
A lucid dream means that you are aware that you're dreaming while you're in the dream.
Yeah. Okay. All the time.
Okay. So this is actually a Tibetan practice. You know, I've done it consciously, and it comes to me. It doesn't happen frequently with me. Some people it does happen frequently with. The reason they practice this is because they, as a practice, we don't do this in Zen, but I think it's valuable. I value dreams a lot. And I'm going to tell you how to, I'm going to give you the instruction for how to practice lucid dreaming. See if you do it. See if you come in next week with a lucid dream. Because what it does, it starts to blur. You're moving from this reality into the dream reality. So both of you are kind of existing in the same reality, which is the dream world, but not entirely the dream world. And this is what they're trying to create, the sense. Because remember when you wake up in a dream and you're having a nightmare, and you wake and there's a part of you that says this is a dream, right? What a relief that is when you finally get that. Well, that's a little bit of the spirit that you're trying to create in this reality. Like, we're waking up. The word, you know what the word Buddha means? Hmm. Buddha means a person who's awake. Mm-hmm. That's what the word Buddha means. So, why is a Buddha awake? The Buddha is more awake than we are. To the Buddha, to a person that's in Buddha consciousness, we're in a dream state. We're dreaming. We're not awake. Do you get it? That's one of the... In what way are we not awake in a way that the Buddha is awake? Well, that's the question that the slogan is trying to get us to see. The Buddha, what does the Buddha see that we don't see? The fundamental thing that he sees that we do not see. Come on, I say this every Sunday.
That emptiness?
Yeah, that we're all connected, right? He fundamentally sees that everything is connected. So nothing at some level is, remember we talked about last week, at one level it's not going to upset him. He sees that it's all totally connected. And on the other level, he has tremendous compassion for just the plight of everybody. He's not indifferent, you know. And that's what makes a Buddha, is that kind of combination, wisdom and compassion. Here's the traditional instruction. You lay on your right side, better than your left side, and much better than your back, and much, much better than your stomach. It's called the lion pose. That's when Buddha went into Parinirvana. He did it on the right side. There's yogic reasons why that is, which I can't explain, but... So you're on the right side. You go to bed at night with the intention that you're going to have a lucid dream. I'd like to have a lucid dream. You also can ask, I'd like to have a dream about my spiritual journey and what will help me. That'd be nice to ask that question. You go to sleep. Then you start to practice. In the early morning when you wake up, if you can remember, like, you know, 4 o'clock when you wake up, you go to the bathroom or whatever, but you're going to go back to sleep. If you wake up, you try to wake up with a consciousness that you're going to go back in and remember the next dream. So you're dreaming at a lighter level. So you often, and you've done this, this is often the way you do lucid dreaming, then you go back in, and there's a part of you that's still closer to the waking consciousness that goes back in. And you can begin to cultivate that ability to go back in, and you can direct your dreams. You can actually begin to, the lucid part of the person can begin to either be more aware as a lucid, you know, saying, oh, I'm in a dream and I'm watching this, but you can also begin to direct the dream further. You can also, the other instruction is, when you go to bed at night, try not to think going to bed. This is an addictive pattern that we all have. We try to process our life before we go to sleep. Try to meditate before you go to bed for 5 minutes. Sitting up or laying down. Count to 10 a couple times. And see if you can be conscious of yourself falling asleep. You can. I do it. So I know you, not every night, but I can do it. You're conscious and you can watch yourself falling asleep. So you're developing the ability to be more conscious as you go to sleep. Real practitioners can do that and follow the consciousness into the dream, into lucid dreaming. Drop it, go into deeper sleep, lose the lucid consciousness, come back and be more conscious of the whole continuity. But to start off with, maybe just a few moments where you just have a lucid dream. See what it is. Just, you're working with that boundary a little bit. Well, that was, we did a lot there. Let's